This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cowain. Richard Stallman's been called the best computer programmer that ever lived. But these days, he's got little time to write programs. In the past decade, intellectual property law has expanded to cover software, and companies are now taking people to court who copy or change their programs. Stallman feels this stifles creativity and makes it harder to use computers, so he founded the Free Software Foundation. It's a group of like-minded, idealistic hackers who are developing their own complete software system, which they give away for free to anyone who can use it. Stallman is also crusading against copyright laws with the League for Programming Freedom. Last year, he received a genius grant from the MacArthur Foundation, which has helped to supplement the $8,000 to $10,000 he was making each year from his programming. Recently, the Free Software Foundation discovered that some hackers were vandalizing their computers. The foundation had been letting anyone freely log onto their computers and help themselves to the software. But the vandals were destroying files and using the foundation's computer as a launching point to attack other systems. Last month, the foundation reluctantly decided to limit access to their computers.
Just recently, we had to change a longstanding policy that I've followed basically as long as I've been using computers for 20 years, which was that I would always let everybody log into the computer using my account. I would never keep a password secret.
It's kind of like giving everyone the key to your home, right?
It's a little bit like that. That's the analogy that comes to everyone's mind, but there's one important difference, which is that if you leave the key to your house outside, nobody is ever going to come in except for a robber. Decent people just don't go around walking into other people's houses. But in my experience, even to this day, just about everyone who logged into my computer was friendly and considerate. And they would do it for various purposes, such as to look for software I was working on, to learn how to use the computer, to write software, to send mail to their friends. It's just a tiny minority that caused trouble. And that's what makes me sad about what happened, because in order to stop these few from deleting files on our machines, we've had to do something that's very bad for a lot of nice people.
What have you had to do? What protective measures have you had to institute?
What happened was we stopped having open accounts that everyone could log in on, and now people can only log in if they have their own accounts with their own passwords. It's as if we had a park that lots of people used, hundreds of people, and a few people started coming in and tearing it up, and so we had to put a fence around it, and now there's a gate with a watchman, and unless you have a special card, you can't get in at all.
Do you feel like, having to do what you did to institute these protective measures, that you've lost a piece of your crusade?
Yes and no. It's important to distinguish between free software and open access to our computer. The Free Software Foundation was doing this, but it's not, strictly speaking, it's not connected with developing free software. We can still do that, and we still do. But I personally feel that I've been forced to do something I'm ashamed of.
Was there ever a time, in your estimation, in computer history, when there was a free-flowing sharing of information, a real give and take?
Well, that's what I found when I got into the field around 1970. Not only the people at the main universities like MIT and Stanford, but even computer companies produced free software, and this was considered natural. It wasn't even considered a special, unusual thing to do.
This was then a truly cooperative relationship at work?
Yes. For example, there was a program originally developed by a digital equipment company, which for one operating system, I got a copy of it and made lots of improvements, made it run on a different operating system. Then people at both Beranek and Newman got that, and they made it work on another operating system and added a lot more improvements, and we kept passing it around.
Was there a sense of community then that was created around this sense of sharing and cooperation?
Well, I definitely felt it.
Is there any semblance of that community today?
Well, I've tried to create a new one. Around 1980, it pretty much died because people at universities discovered that they too could make money by not cooperating. And some of us were outraged to see what the others were doing, but we couldn't see any way to resist it. It's as if society suddenly turned into a dog-eat-dog jungle.
And what began to happen, and how did then this cooperative community become a much more competitive one?
Well, I can pinpoint it exactly, in fact, with a particular project. There was a program called Scribe, developed by a student at Carnegie Mellon University. And instead of sharing it with the rest of us, as we expected, we were shocked to discover he had sold it to a company. And he's since admitted that the program probably got to be used far less as a result of that choice than it would have been if he had shared it with us as usual. But that's what he did. Everyone at MIT was shocked by this, but then people started saying, well, if it's so advantageous to be uncooperative, they started feeling tempted themselves, and a lot of people gave into the temptation.
And the temptation you're describing then is money.
Yes.
As the founder of the League of Programming Freedom, one of the things that you want to do is to remove patent and copyright laws, which you see as obstructionist.
Well, actually, that's not so. The League is not trying to remove copyright laws. Not at all.
What are you trying to do?
The League is trying to bring the interpretation of copyright laws back to the way it was a few years ago.
And then what would those laws be?
Well, a few years ago, everyone had a shared understanding of what copyright law meant in the field of software. It meant you couldn't copy the text of another person's program. But since then, the interpretation has been changed, and now copyright covers the languages that programs speak, the languages that users speak to communicate with programs. When you run a program, there are certain commands. You have to know if I type A, it will do this. If I type B, it will do that. And you have to learn these commands so that you can tell the program what you want it to do. This defines a language, a command language. Now, it's an old tradition in the field of software that people often make new programs compatible with old programs. That means they use the same commands. So if you, a user, have learned to use one program, you can go straight over to the compatible program and use that. Now, if you're a computer user, you can see why compatibility is a good thing. And that's precisely what has been made illegal by the new interpretation of copyright laws. They say that everyone who makes a program has to make it completely incompatible with everything else that exists. And this is what the League for Programming Freedom is trying to reverse.
And the result of these laws, what impact is it having then on programmers and on people that are using software?
Well, one impact it has on software is that it creates monopolies. For example, most spreadsheets that are used are compatible with 123 because users have all learned the commands of 123. Well, this means that if someone wants to make a spreadsheet, you know, we've either got to make it compatible with 123 or most users won't know how to use it and they won't be interested in it. In fact, Lotus sues anybody who makes a spreadsheet that's compatible, and as a result, nobody can do it anymore, and that leads to a monopoly or close to a monopoly for Lotus. And that leads to higher prices for users, less competition, less pressure for improvement.
So that makes then the material exclusive.
Yes. It means that the users have all learned to speak a certain language and Lotus owns the language.
And the effect then on the consumer down at that at the home level?
The effect on them is they'll be stuck with one brand. Imagine if each brand of car had a different kind of controls. Suppose Ford had steering wheels and General Motors had a joystick and Chrysler had a right and left acceleration pedal like a tank. You can imagine if you learn to drive on a Ford and you go to a Chrysler, you're going to crash into something. So you'd be stuck with one brand. And this is, you can see why this is bad for all the consumers.
Another analogy you make, I believe, is to a typewriter keyboard, that what would happen is that every typewriter company would have a completely different configuration of letters.
Right. The typewriter keyboard layout is the user interface of a typewriter. So if these new kinds of copyrights were applied to typewriters, you'd get copyrighted keyboard layouts.
What do you think about the arrangement? I assume it's a kind of a cooperative arrangement between IBM and Apple. Do you see that as kind of working in your direction?
Not particularly. The main thing I think about that is that Apple is one of the companies that is suing people for writing programs that vaguely resemble Apple programs. They're trying to push their monopoly to a broader... They're trying to get a monopoly broader than anything we've ever seen. They're trying to copyright a style. Imagine if Stephen King sued anybody who wrote a horror novel that read as if it might have been written by Stephen King. This would be outrageous, but that's what Apple is doing. And then you look at IBM. IBM has a gigantic number of patents, including patents on software. So they are now telling programmers that they have to get permission to write various sorts of programs because of IBM's patents. So the two of them together, I'm afraid that they could have so many monopolies that nobody else will even be allowed to try to compete with them.
And do you feel the effect of it? Do you feel like you're being shut out?
It's hard to tell. Right now, they're suing Hewlett-Packard and Microsoft. But if they win, they could sue anybody else. And definitely, in order to have a good operating system, we need to have a desktop program. And I'm afraid that anyone who makes a reasonable desktop program will get sued by Apple.
My guest is Richard Stallman. He was part of the legendary group of computer programmers at MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab in the 70s. Now he works to oppose copyright and patent laws that interfere with the development of new computer programs. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Richard Stallman. He's the founder of the Free Software Foundation, which is a charity to develop software. Also one of the founders of the League for Programming Freedom, which is a grassroots organization working to influence laws regarding patents and copyrights, also working against monopolies in computer software. Let me shift the focus here just slightly and talk to you as founder of the Free Software Society, Free Software Foundation. Is there an analogy that works for you in trying to explain to others why computer software should be free?
Well, partly it has to do with how do you live a good life. If I have a program, suppose I'm running a program and a friend comes by and says, "Hey, that's a neat program, I'd like a copy." For me, it seems shameful to say no. The Free Software Foundation aims to give computer users the freedom to copy and change the software that they use. In other words, we're trying to develop a complete system of software with which you will be able to run a computer and do what you want to do on the computer. And you'll be able to make copies of any of that software to give to your friends lawfully. And you'll be able to study how the software works and change it so that it will do exactly what you want it to do.
What makes that such a radical idea? And why is that a challenge to the kind of computer establishment?
Well, most software developers feel that they can get more money if they don't let you do these things. And so they don't. As a result, when you get an ordinary piece of commercial software, you have to make a very painful ethical decision because they make you sign a promise not to copy it. And then when your friend comes by, you either have to say, yes, you can copy it. In that case, you're breaking the promise you made. Or you have to say, no, you can't copy it, in which case you're being a bad friend. So no matter what you do, you can't win. So what I want to do is avoid getting into that position in the first place by using free software.
What do you say to a programmer who says to you, I worked hard on this, I deserve to be paid, I own this program that I created?
Well, first I'd point out that there are several assumptions hidden in that which are actually not true. One of them is that the only way to be paid to write the program is to be able to stop people from using it. Now, that's not so. The Free Software Foundation raises money. We've hired a number of staff people to write programs and write manuals. So one answer is, well, work for an organization that will raise money to pay you to write free software. But there's another answer, which I think is more an ethical answer than a practical answer, and that is the thing that this programmer is asking to do actually wastes the value of the program that's been written. It takes the same amount of work to write a program, whether it's going to be used by 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people. And so if you only let 1,000 people use it because you give them a financial disincentive to use it, you're destroying what you've created.
When you talk about free in the Free Software Foundation, how are you using that word?
Well, the word free has two meanings in English. One has to do with no price, and the other has to do with freedom. In the term free software, I'm talking about freedom, not price. So when a program is free, it means that you, the user, have the freedom to make copies, the freedom to study it and change it and improve it. But it doesn't say anything about whether you pay money to get it. You might get it without paying money, or you might pay money to get it. And the Free Software Foundation, we distribute software in two ways. We put copies on the computer nets, and people can copy that, and they don't have to pay anything. Or they can send us money, and we'll mail them tapes. And that's how we raise most of our money.
My guest has been computer hacker Richard Stallman.